Discussions about how to manage wildlife species can quickly turn complicated. Here's a simple example. Wolves are native to our region, but now the region is full of farms and ranches. Wolves are coming back from near extinction, and clearly not everybody is happy. Trickier example, Diamond Lake in Douglas County. Non-native fish have crowded out the trout fishery on more than one occasion, but the trout are not native either. Which gets us to our first guest, who raises issues with the ethics involved in managing so-called invasive, finger quotes, invasive species. Joseph Joey Tumminello is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at the University of North Texas and our guest on The Exchange. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
So you're not a wildlife biologist. Tell us about how you got into this realm of study.
So I actually got interested in the ethics of invasive species management growing up in South Louisiana, being in areas that were largely surrounded by invasive species such as nutria, which is a rodent from South America that was originally brought in by entrepreneurs in the 20th century for the fur trade. And it eventually failed as a fur commodity, and nutria started eroding large portions of the coastal marsh each year. And so I was aware of those sorts of issues, and at the same time that they were welcomed in areas like the city park near where I grew up. And so as I went through my undergraduate and graduate training in philosophy, I started looking at areas where we could look at these kind of assumptions and presuppositions that aren't often brought to light, and so that we can examine them and kind of scrutinize them. And I realized that there hadn't been very much stuff done yet on the ethics of invasive species management, though people were starting to become interested in that. And I'm also kind of fascinated with the tension between, for instance, animal and environmental activism, as well as human versus non-human or more than human interests. And I see invasion biology and wildlife management as important areas where we can look at those sorts of issues.
More than human interest is an interesting term. Does this get us into the realm of animal rights and that sort of stuff?
Right. Yeah, that is a term that people have recently introduced as opposed to non-human, rather than strictly defining everything that's not human in terms of the negation of the human, kind of acknowledging that there are whole worlds of experience that are largely unfathomable to us, and trying to, I think, promote the importance of at least developing some sense of respect for that.
Do you take issue with the very terminology, Joe, of invasive species, for example?
Well, that was some of my initial research, and I did my master's thesis on an animal ethics perspective on invasive species management, is the rhetoric and terminology that's used in this. And I mean, just in general, I see invasion biology as a wonderful illustration of the way that facts and values are interwoven with one another. And so there has been this trend, though I think maybe it's waning in certain areas, of seeing facts and values as completely distinct entities. And that's also related to this idea of knowledge and fact, whereas whenever we talk about ethics, people sometimes construe that as strictly a matter of personal or subjective opinion. And yet, whenever we examine issues such as these issues within invasion biology, we can see that a lot of this is interwoven. So the issue, I was interviewed by Oregon Public Broadcasting last month regarding the issue in Diamond Lake, right? And so as you were just mentioning, the introduction of the tui chub, the recent efforts to control or eradicate that to allow for the trout fishing, that the trout were also introduced, though. And so I think a lot of the rhetoric, the distinction between invasive and native, the distinction between just introduced or exotic species and those that are then considered invasive, right, are not strictly neutral facts about the world, but are ethically and politically charged. And they're a way for us to see how our values are embedded in these sorts of concepts.
Joseph Joey Tumminello is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a doctoral candidate in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at the University of North Texas. We're talking about the ethics of invasive species management. You can join this conversation on the Exchange. You might have some thoughts of your own about how we go about identifying one species as invasive and one as native or as non-native. There's a bunch of terms in here we'll get to. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jess Burns from OPB actually works in our newsroom, which is part of how we made the connection with you, and she's the one who I think interviewed you about Diamond Lake. Really interesting situation there, though, because you're talking about the tui chub being considered non-native, and then this other situation where they're bringing in the tiger trout, which are also non-native, to try to control the tui chub population. And also all to protect a trout fishery, which is in itself not necessarily native, not native to the lake, not necessarily, period. Boom, not.
Right. Yeah, so it's interesting in that sense because, yeah, one form of control for invasive species is sometimes called biological control methods, where you're actually introducing new species into that area to try to control the alleged invasive species. And I also think, if I understand the issue correctly, that they have in the past just completely poisoned the lake. And
last time, 10 years ago, yes.
And in the maybe considering doing that again as well?
No, I don't know if it's on the table firmly now. Okay. It's like a last resort, I mean, because they've done it twice already.
Right. And so I think, of course, when it comes to ethics in general, I think that it's complex. There's a lot of importance of taking context and particularities into account. And so, you know, I'm not always offering final ethical prescriptions, but one thing that's interesting here is that I think it's important to ask this question: to what extent are we willing to make these dramatic impacts on the environment for human, and in this case, I think at least in part, economic interests? Now, tradition and identity are important components in our decision-making. Fishing obviously has a lot of traditional and import in terms of how we see ourselves in relation to the world, and so I don't think that should be neglected. But we should also consider and weigh that along with other interests. And so, for instance, that's whether or not the environment apart from humans has value for its own sake, independent of the way in which we use it. A lot of people consider sentience or the capacity to suffer and experience pleasure as an important determining factor in whether or not a living being has moral worth. And so there is growing consensus in the scientific community that fish fall into that category, that they're actually capable of suffering, not just responding reflexively to stimuli. And so those are also important interests that I think should be factored into our decision making about the environment.
You get into situations like what we talked about last week. Jordan Fisher Smith was with us talking about his book, Engineering Eden, where you're trying to create an environment a certain way, but you're not even sure if you're restoring something that once existed, creating something that never existed, or getting to a place that you're just essentially starting fresh.
Yeah, that's right. And that's been, I think, a salient critique of ecological restoration practices. What is the sort of situation are we trying to recreate? Are we trying to create a new situation? And in this context, what role might invasive species play in that? And so some of the fascinating work I'm seeing coming out of some environmental journalism is, for instance, the book The New Wild by Fred Pierce, where the subtitle is actually Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation. Very provocative. But looking at the possibility of taking advantage of invasive species for like rewilding purposes in conjunction with ecological restoration. And so another one also, Beyond the War on Invasive Species by Tao O'Ryan, looking at similar issues. And so people are, and you know, even within the biological community, Daniel Botkin has written a paper called The Naturalness of Biological Invasions, where given the dynamic nature of ecology, invasion, at least in certain cases, is beneficial to the perpetuation of life. And so, yeah, all those factors interested in taking those into account as we figure out what to do in these particular cases.
Joey Tumminello is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a doctoral candidate at the University of North Texas in philosophy and religion. We're talking about ethics in invasive species management, and obviously a conversation we have fairly often around this neck of the woods with all the different critters that we have coming and going. You can join this discussion on the Exchange. Give your own thoughts about how we value one species over another and what that means to how we manage for them. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. That term invasion biology, is that your own?
No. So invasion biology is considered a category of biology. The department that I'm in philosophy is actually housed in an environmental science building where we promote a lot of interdisciplinary collaboration among philosophers and scientists in this way. And so there are a number of people who are actively working in that field. There's a journal called Invasion Biology. So no, that's not my term. That is one that has been explicitly adopted by practitioners in that field. And it generally is correlated with the, I believe in around 1958 and throughout the early 60s, we saw the emergence of what became known as invasion biology.
All right, we have a call here from Cynthia in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking ethics and invasive species management with Joey Tumanello.
Yeah, I wanted to point out that in nature, the ecosystems that are the most diverse generally are the most resilient. And so rather than trying to say, well, what was or what's most native or those kinds of judgments, it might be better to approach it from what species, plant and animal, work well alongside other plants and animals and don't become, you know, the only plant or animal. And, of course, humans are the most invasive species ever because we have pretty much done that. But anyway, I just thought that was an important part of the conversation.
A diversified ecosystem rather than a monoculture like a tree plantation. Thanks for that, Cynthia. Appreciate it. Thoughts, Joey?
Thank you, Cynthia. Excellent point. So whenever I first began kind of looking at the conceptual issues in invasion biology, and a lot of my early work emerged as a conceptual critique of that field. And of course, you can point to ambiguities, you know, in terminology anywhere you look. In this case, I thought it was really interesting because looking at that concept of invasiveness, and others have critiqued the vagueness of that, also within biology, people who are working in that. Is it dependent on time? If so, how long? How long does a species need to be in a particular place before it's considered native? Is it more of a matter of ecological fit, as maybe Cynthia was kind of gesturing towards there? If so, what are the kind of criteria that we're trying to establish for that? A lot of times it happens to, the ascription of that term happens to be connected with impacts on humans and conveniences or inconveniences or economic or ecological burdens that we perceive as being harmful. And in relation to the final point she made, I think that's a great point. I'm always a little apprehensive in bringing it up, but I think that it's salient in the sense that regardless of what criteria you're using to try to determine if a given species is invasive in a particular area, people have not really explicitly entertained the possibility that humans, or at least I would say certain communities or groups or individual humans, could be considered invasive according to, you know, whatever criteria people want to try to employ. And also, I mean, it's acknowledged widely that the vast majority of introductions that lead to what we consider invasive species are human introduced, often intentionally, where many of the staple crops that we use are not considered invasive, but they have been introduced. A lot of reptile and fish species were introduced as food sources and later became invasive. And so it's interesting to think about the way, I think it's a good way of illustrating how those terms are charged, and that these species are, you know, members of these species are ultimately doing what they do to survive as members of a given species, and it happens to be in a place that we've put them in that causes them to behave in ways that we take to be detrimental.
Is there specificity in the choice of terminology non-native versus invasive? I mean, is there a different term for the creatures that show up in a place by themselves? Because, for example, they've begun to migrate northward with changing climates.
So invasive is not strict. It's not only restricted to human-introduced species. It is, so basically, I guess maybe a non-invasive but introduced species are sometimes just called introduced, or sometimes if they're not introduced by humans, they're referred to as exotic or just non-native.
Okay, so when you get to trying to figure out which species belong where, you're really at the nub of it getting into human judgments about what has value in the landscape and not, sometimes scientifically, sometimes economically, as in the case of nutria in Louisiana that you pointed out.
Absolutely. Again, I think that it's one of the things that, again, going back to that fact-value dichotomy or the lack thereof, I think the whole field is a great illustration of the way that our facts and values are interwoven. And that doesn't mean that it's doomed or anything. It just means that it's a human endeavor. And all of the sciences, just like the humanities and other human practices, the arts, and our everyday lives. You know, these, I think these things, facts and values, are interwoven in important ways that we should attend to. And it doesn't mean that we have to reject those practices necessarily because of that.
We have a few more minutes to talk about ethics and invasive species management with Joseph Joey Tuminello. He's a doctoral candidate at the University of North Texas in philosophy and religion. You can join us on the exchange, maybe your own observations about how we have dealt with so-called invasive species in the landscape and how you think they might be dealt with. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So, Joey, is there a particular approach that you recommend in dealing with critters that are not where they used to be, and in the case, for example, of Diamond Lake, can potentially crowd out the ones that that we prefer there?
So I really think that if I had to make some kind of basic recommendation, it's that there is probably not just one particular approach or technique. And so I'm again, as I mentioned, like my approach to ethics in general is heavily contextual and I would say particularist. And so I think my most general recommendation would be to take this on a case-by-case basis and to make sure that, I think, you know, ethical decisions are often best made as community members. And so taking into account the positions, the perspectives of the stakeholders, the people who, and not just the people necessarily, but those beings who are affected or impacted by a given situation, is probably going to yield the most favorable sort of outcome. And that, again, that doesn't mean that we have to restrict that to people. And then questions about who should count as a community stakeholder then are raised in a philosophical fashion, right? So in this case, I mean, given the way that these decisions, like in Diamond Lake, are impacting the lives of other beings, maybe, you know, regardless of what the final, you know, right thing to do is, those should be taken into account as far as we can as well. It doesn't mean that they're always going to prevail, but to completely neglect those interests of other beings and of historically marginalized groups, human and non-human, you know, I think that it's important to try to take all of those positions into account and make this a collaborative effort.
You were talking a little bit about your master's thesis, which I did get a chance to peruse, and I also looked at the recent paper called Humaneness in Invasive Species Management, and that one begs the question whether there are specific control techniques that you would like to see not be used anymore.
Sure. So I point to a couple of case studies in the Humaneness in Invasive Species Management, which was adapted from my master's thesis, and so I was looking at the relevance of sentience as a factor in invasive species management decisions. And there seems to be an assumption that once a species is deemed invasive, I mean, the question that I'm raising is, does that strip that members of that species, or at least in this particular location, of their moral worth, assuming that they had it in the first place? And I don't think that it does. So I'm not saying in those papers, I'm not saying that nothing should ever be done against members of, you know, sentient invasive species. Now, most invasive species are not animal species. But whenever we're looking at those, how can we prioritize humaneness in a way that it's sometimes historically been neglected within invasion biology and wildlife management? So I looked at, for instance, in South Louisiana, where I grew up, there's a bounty program where people are paid, I think, $5 per tail of a nutria. And so that encourages people to help control them. As I mentioned, they erode a large portion of the coastal marsh each year. Yet, as far as I have seen, there is not necessarily control for pain management. You can go to maybe the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries or one of the official Louisiana governmental websites and go through this process where you're then allowed to hunt them, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe having methods that might be less cost efficient, right, which makes a huge difference, but take pain into account, even in cases where there's no better option, right? But mm-hmm. being able to develop an openness towards more humane practices and, you know, ideally practices that are non-lethal, I think would be a good direction to head in.
And Elizabeth in Eureka is on the line with another issue from our area. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi. I don't know much about this. It's just what I read in the paper and kind of reacted to. I was kind of appalled to hear. A couple of years ago, there was a plan to shoot the barred owls that had moved in from...
Because they're crowding out the spotted owls, yeah, yeah. In fact, they have agreed with a pilot project to go ahead and shoot some of them. So let's get Joey's view of that. Thanks for the call, Elizabeth. Thanks so much.
Yes, thanks, Elizabeth. So I guess in regards to situations like that, the questions that I would be interested in would be something along the lines of, you know, who's making this determination and why, who is allowed or not allowed to do the shooting. Should they actually be shot? And a lot of times people in invasion biology and wildlife management are not just obviously not waiting until a species becomes very detrimental in whatever way they want to measure that, but are trying to anticipate this. And so there are times where, and there are ways that they try to measure this sort of thing, where if a species seems like it could be very detrimental ecologically or economically, they'll try to take some action that could be looked at as preventative. So I would want to, you know, have some kind of clear analysis and public engagement on if, and if so, then why this is an issue where we need to take lethal action.
Becca in Lane County writes, doesn't seem that in our global world we can block off things to certain areas. This show is great because the guest and callers are really discussing our modern world. In nature, the strong will survive and move and sometimes push out others. Fern Ridge Lake is my favorite invasive species entertainment venue. Huge carp and noisy bullfrogs. Thanks for that from Rebecca. Becca in Lane County.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, yeah, this is just one illustration of the dynamic nature of the world we live in that's been really perpetuated by globalization. And so it's important to see invasion biology and the management of invasive species through that lens as well.
Just a couple seconds left here. Joey, do you have any allies in PETA and similar organizations? Do they tend to take up your standard?
I think that I do some animal advocacy work that's largely in relation to agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure of the particular perspectives on that by various animal advocacy groups, though I was initially attracted to this because of this tension that I saw with environmental and animal activism in invasive species management.
Okay. Joey Tuminello at the University of North Texas, thanks for joining us today to talk about ethics and species management.
Thank you for having me.